SEC fans, welcome to the Saturday Down South podcast, coming to you from the iHeartMedia studio, WDAE in Tampa, Florida, 620 AM, 95.3 FM. My name is John Crist, senior writer for Saturday Down South. His name is Connor O'Gara, national columnist for Saturday Down South. Follow me on Twitter at SaturdayJC. Follow him at CJ O'Gara. Connor, I think our chemistry is getting better week to week, so how about we jump back in the lab? All right, before we get rolling, take care of some bills here. The Saturday Down South podcast is brought to you by Ticket City. College football is on its way, thank the Lord. Some major SEC matchups are coming at us. Alabama, Florida State, Michigan, Florida, Georgia, Notre Dame. So now's the time to get your tickets. We've been working with Ticket City for a long time. They are the experts in the field. They've served over 1.5 million customers, and they're the place to go. They have been for 30-some years. They're offering $20 off for all of our podcast listeners. All you need to do is visit TicketCity.com, enter the discount code SDS20 at checkout, and you're going to get $20 off your order. Again, TicketCity.com, discount code SDS20. So, Connor, we're a lot closer to kickoff for college football than the last time we talked. I know that midnight madness in basketball is a little more important where you went to school, but let's keep it on the gridiron, shall we say.
Let's do that. It's weird to think about a weekend in which we're going to have college football. There are no more weekends without college football.
Correct.
Until December here. So let's thank the good Lord for that and talk some SEC.
Yes, our social lives will take a serious hit, but it's a small price to pay to earn a paycheck doing what we do. Let's get rolling here with a couple of columns I wrote this week. It was sort of a series of three, not intentionally necessary. But one idea sort of spawned the next. My most intriguing player in the SEC for 2017. And then I wrote another column on Tuesday for most intriguing team. And then another one for Wednesday, my most intriguing coach in the conference. So I'm curious what yours were compared to mine. My most intriguing player is Mississippi State quarterback Nick Fitzgerald. I do think the Bulldogs can be sneaky in the West. Dude, I think they challenge for Atlanta. No, I don't, but just with what we've seen at the quarterback position from a development perspective, Dan Mullen with Tim Tebow, Dan Mullen with Dak Prescott, I know those are incredibly high hurdles to jump, but Nick Fitzgerald is a guy who might be really scary really fast, and who knows if he's capable of pulling an upset or two. I bet he does.
Yeah, and the Dak comp is interesting with him. Everybody looks at the history of quarterbacks with Dan Mullen, of course, with Tebow and with Dak more recently. And don't tell me that Dak's transcendent start doesn't have anything to do with a bit of the start to his NFL career, that is. Don't tell me that hasn't added to the potential upside of Nick Fitzgerald. I think people are seeing him a little bit in a different light than maybe they would have coming into last season. And I think the hype is kind of building. And now that we've had time to sit back and look at the body of work that he put together, you're absolutely right. He is intriguing. I can't really think of a more intriguing player in the SEC than him and what he's going to be asked to do for this offense, because he's going to have to do a ton of heavy lifting. And not many guys, you can maybe make the argument that he's the most valuable guy to his team in the entire SEC. That argument could definitely be made at this point in August. Now, will it be in a couple months? I don't know. But for now, I'm all on board with that idea.
Yeah, the Prescott cop is obvious. Not only the same program, the same position, but the same coach. I'm wondering if this is borderline unfair for Nick Fitzgerald. But they have a similar story on the recruiting trail. Prescott was sort of looked over. He was actually a two-star kid, lucky to get a third star his last year of high school. Nobody really wanted him. TCU took a peak, but they went with Trevon Boykin instead. LSU said, sure, come on, but you got to be a tight end or a linebacker. You're not going to be a quarterback. And then he does what he does. He's the best player to ever put on the maroon and white, and he's already an absolute superstar 1 year into his NFL career. So Fitzgerald, again, lowly rated, three-star. Mullen only had to fight off UT Chattanooga to get this young man's signature on National Signing Day. He threw like 70 passes his entire senior year of high school, so there wasn't much of a book on the kid. But, of course, the comparison is going to be made, But as I mentioned earlier, how much is that just flat out unfair to this young man, saying, look, if you're not as good as Dak Prescott, you can't take us to the same places?
It is unfair. You're right in that regard. But do I think that he can have the same type of impact for this offense? I think he can come close to it. I absolutely do. I mean, if you look at what he did as a sophomore last year, I did a side-by-side comparison of their usage, and he accounted for 66% of Mississippi State's yards as a sophomore. Dak was only at 49%, and, you know, Dak, of course, then by the time he was a senior, was up to 73% of Mississippi State's yards came from him. But you're looking at a kid that just did a lot of really impressive things as a sophomore, and his upside, yeah, you know, he wasn't this hyped recruit, which is a little bit weird to talk about in the SEC, talking about transcendent players potentially that weren't big-time recruits. But I think that people that have watched him play, and we're going to talk a little bit more about this later with our quarterback discussion, but I think people that have watched him play and seen just how tough this kid is are impressed, and he's a kid that many people are going to root for around college football. This is the year I think that he becomes more of a national name, because I think, you know, he is still a little bit more of a local guy. The numbers certainly don't indicate it, but I think, you know, this is the year that he kind of grows his national brand, and we kind of realize, hey, Dan Mullen is pretty good at this quarterbacks thing.
Yeah, he's obviously very good at the quarterback thing, and that legend for him is just growing by the day. We saw that at Media Days about a month ago. Of course, Fitzgerald needs to get better against top-flight competition. It's not that hard to do a game-by-game summary and see that, sure, he's lighting up, you know, UMass, and he's destroying Ole Miss when they've totally given up on their season. But when he faces an LSU or an Auburn or an Alabama, a team with a legit defense, he hasn't gotten it done. So that's the next step for him. But if it's not Fitzgerald, since it's, you know, that was my column, if you were writing that column and it wasn't Nick Fitzgerald, who do you think is the most intriguing player in the league?
I might go with Jacob Eason. And
sure.
Eason, you know, it's easy to pick on the quarterbacks just because of, you know, they're in the spotlight all the time. And with a kid like Eason, he comes in as this highly touted recruit, and everybody knows who he is by the time he steps on campus, of course. But just seeing him grow in that offense really, really interests me, because if Georgia can get that running back tandem healthy for the full season, Isaac Nada is expected to take a big leap. And if they can just, I've said it so many times this preseason, but if they can just establish that downfield threat and really maximize Eason's ability to connect deep, I think that's kind of a game changer. And he's going to see that rise that everybody expects him to. At the same time, you're looking at a guy that had a lot of struggles last year, and there were defenses that just flat out took away the pass from Georgia, and they just flat out could not throw the ball. So you're looking at a guy that has a ton of potential, and he's going to put together highlight reel plays. He's going to be really fun to watch. But at the same time, we're still the range of what we could potentially get out of Eason in year two is going to be fascinating to watch, I think.
Yeah, having enough arm will never be that young man's problem. He needs better blocking, and he needs more consistent pass catchers on the outside. Most intriguing team. This is actually the second year in a row I went with Tennessee, albeit for decidedly different reasons. I went with the Volunteers again because I don't know what we're going to get on Rocky Top this year. 2016 was supposed to be the year. They had all those stars. They had a senior quarterback in Joshua Dobbs. Yes, they had a tough middle part of the schedule, but early and late, it was pretty manageable. They had big-time players at every level on defense, and this was year four for Butch Jones. All his guys, no more excuses about Derek Dooley, Lane Kiffin, et cetera, et cetera. They disappointed. So now so many of those big-time guys are gone. No more Dobbs, no more Derek Barnett, no more Cameron Sutton. The list goes on and on. And there aren't a lot of expectations. So if they find a way to win 9 games again with no expectations outside of Knoxville, I'd be very impressed with Coach Jones, and I think he's the guy there. But if they slide back to 6 or 7, which I'm sort of projecting, that seat is going to get very hot very quickly. I think it's quite intriguing what's going to go on this year with the Tennessee Volunteers.
And as long as Butch is there, I think that's going to be the case. He's built up his national brand to the point where we overanalyze everything. He's one of those guys now that we overanalyze everything he says, just because some of the things that have come out of his mouth in the last year have just been so polarizing and quotable. But I think you're right. I think that's a fair a fair thing to throw out there. I mean, you add in the fact that the quarterback situation is such a big unknown right now. We're still waiting to see what that defense can do in year two of Stoops. And you know, this is just a team that we really think that we have a good idea of them every preseason, but then it just changes so drastically so soon. And can this be the year that maybe they sneak up on a couple teams in the East and maybe they just put together that year that we've all been waiting for? Who knows? But they definitely have the ability to just kind of make national headlines. And, you know, these games are just going to be, if, you know, they do get off to a rough, if they do get off to a rough start, you know, the hot seat kind of, that conversation grows a little bit. And Butch Jones just becomes one of the more interesting figures in all of college football.
Yeah, a lot of Vols fans have been in my mentions for all the reasons you anticipate, especially talking about the defense. You know, they were so banged up on that side of the ball last year. I got all the people on Rocket Top saying, look, our young guys got so much experience last year. You know, Jalen Reeves, Maben was hurt so much, and Cam Sutton missed half the season. Yes, you got lots of young kids some experience, but I don't know if bad experience is a good thing. When these experienced, now experienced freshmen and sophomores are giving up 417 yards passing to Vanderbilt's Kyle Shurmur, I don't know if you want to bring these guys back. So, again, similar question. If it's not Tennessee, if you were writing that column this week, who is your most intriguing team in the conference?
Well, I'd probably go with Florida, actually.
Okay.
I think Florida, and not just for the quarterback situation. That, of course, has been getting so much attention, and we've paid attention to it, obviously, on this podcast. But just the situation that's developing outside of it, this whole Antonio Callaway thing, is he going to stay on the team? Is he going to be suspended for more than one game? Is that offense ever going to look like a Florida, like the Florida offense that we saw under Urban Meyer? Like these different dynamics that are kind of going into what is making up Jim McElwain's reputation right now in year three is really intriguing, because I think the way that they ended the regular season last year kind of soured people a little bit on McElwain, and people aren't necessarily convinced that he can, you know, consistently beat top-flight competition. Part of that obviously has to do with the struggles against Florida State. But, you know, you're looking at a guy that has been to two straight conference championship games, but I don't think everybody's really sold on him. And it'll be I'm very curious as to what the narrative surrounding McElwain is, if this is an eight-win season, if there are more problems off the field, if this quarterback situation doesn't get figured out and doesn't look like what it should and what many are expecting it to, how is the world going to view Jim McElwain is going to be a really interesting topic of discussion. And I think there are just so many different factors that go into, you know, Florida's situation this year and whether or not they're going to be able to make another run in the East. That's a team that I'm going to have my eye on very closely throughout the season.
Another thing to consider, McElwain already a very testy relationship with Gator Nation. Clearly big expectations when you wear that orange and blue, and he just kind of does it his own way. He doesn't worry about the outside noise. That's fine when you're winning, but when you're struggling, it makes him want to hit the eject button that much faster. Okay, let's move on to most intriguing coach. We've already talked about the Bulldogs a little bit. I went with Kirby Smart. My most intriguing coach for the 2017 campaign, year two for him between the hedges. He's got the best team in the East on paper, should make it to Atlanta. This is a team that has underachieved before he got there, but this is not a Butch Jones situation. He walked into a pretty solid program. They were coming off back-to-back 10-win seasons. Coach Richt had won 10 games, four of his last five, before they decided to get him out the door. So there was already talent on campus. There was already a history of winning. This was not a turnaround situation. Coach Smart was brought in to establish Tuscaloosa East and to get the Bulldogs over the hump. And instead of disappointing in the East, getting to the SEC title game, becoming a college football playoff contender, and doing, of course, what Nick Saban has done, despite how impossible it is to match that level of success. So this is a guy who I'm going to be watching very closely. He does things much differently than Coach Richt did. So this is a program that's in the middle of a sea change, and we'll see if it makes the result on Saturday.
Yeah, and, you know, this is a year where I think it's all set up really well for Georgia to make that run in the East. And, you know, can you win a division title in what many consider to be a lackluster division, a lackluster Power 5 division, where there really isn't that dominant team at the top of it. These are the things you have to do if you're Kirby Smart. These are the reasons that you were brought here, because, you know, Coach Rick wasn't getting to Atlanta consistently, and this was a team that wasn't maximizing its potential. And if you have another year where maybe that narrative kind of surfaces again, all right, well, what are we getting out of Kirby Smart? What is he going to be the coach that's going to take us to that next level, or is all of a sudden, you know, the narrative changing against him too? So he's absolutely intriguing. He's all the more intriguing if they are to get to that SEC championship game and face off against Nick Saban in Alabama. Man, can you think of, like, just maybe one story to write for that? I don't know. That seems like it's kind of lacking narratives there, isn't it?
Those are the stories we need, because they write themselves. Again, that was my column for Wednesday. That was my pick for most intriguing coach in the league with Kirby Smart. Again, third time I'll ask the question. If you wrote the column, you would choose whom?
I'd probably go Brett Bielema, actually.
Okay.
And, yeah, new
Big
kid,
Ten roots.
New Brett, new Bert. But I think his situation is a little bit different than maybe anybody in the SEC, just because of his whole demeanor. We've talked about it on this podcast before. He has a way of just kind of changing the perception of himself, just because of his attitude about coaching, about the way that he deals with fans, the way that he is on social media. And his seat doesn't feel that hot. But at the same time, what happens if he wins five games? What happens if he wins six games? Is he done? Is Arkansas really willing to cut bait on a guy that still has a pretty solid track record? So that's something to obviously that everybody's going to watch for. But I don't know. I think he's up there. And nationally speaking, there might not be a more intriguing coach than him, because he's also never been in this situation before where he's felt the pressure to win right now. I mean, he's kind of had a little bit of leeway there to build that program back up, considering what he took over. But how does he handle all this? Is he still the same fun-loving guy, or do we see a different side of him this year? So that's going to be something that we're definitely going to watch for. And if they win, you know, obviously I think that you know, all that talk goes away in a hurry. But he's definitely got a unique situation this year.
I am high on the Hogs this year. I have them third in the West, winning nine games. But I got to say, I look behind me and I don't feel a lot of support, even from the folks in Fayetteville. Maybe I'm just sort of throwing something at the bullseye here and seeing if I can hit something. But I like what I see there, but not a lot of other people do. We'll see. So let's spin it off my content and go to something you wrote this week. Very interesting topic. I don't think it's been talked about very much at all, as a matter of fact. It caught me very off guard when we talked about it in one of our staff meetings. The title is very apropos. Why the heck is Mississippi native Steve McNair not in the College Football Hall of Fame? Perhaps we found the answer. That was your column from a couple of days ago. I know you did some solid investigative reporting on this one. For people who don't remember Steve McNair, which drives me crazy at 42 years old, he was one of the original just spread option maniacs. What he did at Alcorn State, granted not at the Division I level, but just put up video game numbers rarely seen before. And then he ends up going to the Tennessee Titans, ultimately the Baltimore Ravens, took the Titans to a Super Bowl. He was a yard away from winning it. An incredible, incredible career. A game-changing quarterback. Did things that a lot of people really hadn't seen before. Did things back when the black quarterback still wasn't as accepted as it is in 2017. I got to ask the same question that you do. How is this guy not in the Hall of Fame?
So I basically went into the story knowing just that he wasn't in the College Football Hall of Fame. I knew he wasn't in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, but I decided to, you know, keep my focus on just the College Football Hall of Fame. And for all the aforementioned reasons that you just listed right there, all right, I understand that it's at, you know, the FCS, what used to be Division I AA level, but how could this guy not be in the College Football Hall of Fame? I mean, he has done everything possible to get there. So, you know, I did a little bit of research, and his brother is the coach at Alcorn State, which is where Steve went and starred as a senior in high school, or as a senior in college, where he finished third in the Heisman voting. So his brother Fred is a coach there, and long story short, I talked to Fred, and he's like, yeah, I had no idea. I've never heard any nomination. I've never gotten You know, any explanation from you know, the Football Writers Association of America or National Football Foundation, anything like that, anybody that would have any sort of insight, he has never been given it. So, you know, I basically decided to do a little bit more digging, and I pretty much asked I asked the National Football Foundation point blank, like, all right, why is this guy not in there? Just sent him a simple email, and a spokesperson told me, well, actually, it doesn't come down to any of the small school stuff. It has nothing to do with the way that he tragically died in a murder-suicide. Nothing to do with any of that. As it turns out, Alcorn State never sent in the nomination forms. It's like, oh, okay, well, that's a little odd. I think just a few sheets of paper would, you know, not be enough to keep somebody out of a, you know, the College Football Hall of Fame. So, essentially, you know, what I did was, you know, I wrote the story with all that background and that exchange of information. And as soon as I learned that information from the National Football Foundation, I sent an email to Alcorn State, who I had been dealing with, and they never responded to me. And I felt that was just kind of odd that they didn't have really an explanation as to why this measure had never been taken. It's a small school. It's not something that they do very often. But, you know, maybe it just slipped through the cracks. So, you know, I even went as far as to, you know, I contacted Ole Miss to find out how they got Patrick Willis on the ballot. And, you know, they went through a nomination process 2 years before he was even eligible to be on the ballot. And he had to go through a district screening process as well. But anyways, Steve McNair is not in the College Football Hall of Fame because of paperwork. At least that's the explanation I've been given. And it can happen. And he is perfectly eligible. Now, whether or not he gets in, that's a different subject, but to at least get on the ballot, he is absolutely eligible. All that has to happen are a few nomination forms.
Yeah, just to provide a little more background information, he's never going to make the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton. He was a very good NFL player, but not an elite player. A good one, not a great one, is just the best way to describe him. He had the splash season to get to the Super Bowl. If you're a fantasy player, surely he started for you at some point. But what this guy did in college was just positively incredible. I think his last year alone at Alcorn State, he accounted for almost 6,000 total yards, rushing and passing, 53 total touchdowns. The numbers are positively mind-blowing, and you're right about Alcorn State. How often do we talk about Alcorn State football except next to never? You would think that they would love to get this guy in the College Football Hall of Fame, give that program a little publicity, give him a little nice honor, granted posthumously, but I'm wondering if this is sort of an O.J. Simpson situation. You mentioned the fact that he died tragically, and just to be frank, he died tragically under some very screwy circumstances. As the story goes, he was having an extramarital affair with a 20-year-old girl, and that was where the murder-suicide came into play. And maybe Alcorn State is trying to distance itself from its most celebrated player of all time. That's just a guess. I have no confirmation. You have done a lot more research on this subject than I do, but it brings back to the movie Contact, you know, with Jodie Foster and Matthew McConaughey. They talk about Occam's razor. Occam's razor means the simplest explanation, chances are, is the correct one. That's the simplest explanation I have. I don't know if you have another theory out there.
Occam's razor? What the hell are you talking about?
Contact's an underrated movie.
Wow, that's another discussion for another time. But I'll disagree with that just simply for the fact that I've been working so close with Alcorn State to write this story up until I told them that piece of information, that it was a simple issue of paperwork that hadn't been filled out. So, because I had been in, you know, contact with Fred, they even sent me pictures to be able to use for the story. So I don't think they're embarrassed by anything at all. I don't, you know, Steve, I even put it in the story, you know, it'll be interesting to see if he does get on the ballot, if you know, people do decide to vote him in or not, because there is something in there that says, you know, post-football career matters, you know, your character matters, what you do off the field. Okay, but there are a lot of criminals that are in the College Football Hall of Fame. Steve McNair was never, ever arrested for and charged with a major crime. Yes, the way that he went out was certainly not ideal, but the body of work is just so, so impressive what this guy did in college. Here's something that not a lot of people realize that I found doing this story. You know, ESPN2 didn't used to broadcast like random college football games back in the day. Well, they started essentially broadcasting Alcorn State's games because everybody wanted a piece of Steve McNair. He was on the cover of Sports Illustrated. This guy was a known Heisman candidate throughout his entire senior season. Sports Illustrated story even said, hand him the Heisman on the cover of it. I mean, this is just a guy who sort of transcended college football in a way. And he could have went to Florida and been a defensive back, and he decided, you know what, no, I want to play quarterback. I'm from this small town in Mississippi, and I don't care if I have to go to a small school to make it. I'm going to do it, and I'm going to play the position I feel that I'm best at. So it was just really interesting kind of learning about all these different dynamics about what goes into this process and the way that, you know, how a simple miscommunication can be the result of something that seems like such a, you know, such a weird oversight to make. I've never done a story quite like this, and I'm not even sure if it's really a story that's resolved. It's kind of incomplete in a way.
Further backdrop here, he finished third in the Heisman Trophy voting behind Rashawn Salaam and Kaijana Carter. You know, Rashawn Salaam, first round pick for our beloved Chicago Bears, basically smoked weed and ate himself out of the league. Kaijana Carter had a chance to be a fantastic player, just way too many injuries, way too soon. Just sort of a woulda, shoulda, coulda with that young man. McNair, of course, an incredible NFL career, not Hall of Fame worthy, but clearly the best of those three guys. So what happens with Alcorn State? You've hung up with all these people. Is this rectified simply by firing the secretary and finding somebody who could fill in this paperwork? Do they need to hire a new SID who makes this a priority? When you hung up the phone with these people and exchanged emails with these people, were you any more confident that this was actually going to get done, or are they just sort of scratching their heads saying, hey, we don't know what to do?
You know, I think it will get done eventually. I think not hearing back a response after I had been in such regular contact with them was maybe a sign that, you know, they were, I don't know if they're embarrassed by this. I don't want to put words in their mouth. Their SID, he went through tremendous lengths to help me out. I really appreciate it. But just a weird situation. It just kind of makes you feel bad for a guy. You know, Steve McNair's not here anymore. He can't fight for his legacy. He can't, you know, campaign and email this person, email that person. And, yeah, his brother's alive, and you know, but his brother's got a lot of things on his plate too, and he's, you know, the coach of a college football team, and even, you know, a media relations staff has a lot of things to worry about preparing for a college football season. And sometimes, you know, when you're a staff of maybe one or two people, things like this just fall through the cracks at smaller schools. It doesn't happen at a place like Ole Miss. I found that really interesting doing a story on Patrick Willis about how they emailed them 2 years in advance. Like, that's how much Ole Miss wanted to make sure that this happened, to make sure that Patrick Willis got on the ballot as soon as he possibly could and that he can get into the Hall of Fame as soon as he possibly could. It just, like, the dynamic is just different when, you know, they have more people to take care of, more responsibilities, and this might just be a case of a school that's being spread too thin and it slipped through the cracks. And you know what? Maybe this sheds some light on the situation, and this gives Steve the recognition that obviously he deserves.
You know, Alcorn State is not Alabama when it comes to a recruiting perspective, but I think one way to get maybe more kids to go play football there, instead of walking them through the halls and their official visits saying, yeah, Steve McNair played here, if you were able to say, yeah, Steve McNair, College Football Hall of Famer, played here, that sounds a little better. I think they should push a little paperwork and get it done. I don't think it's that hard. I think that the excuses are a little silly. Maybe there's something going on that we don't know here, but
right.
The point is that your column is 100% correct. How this guy is not in the Hall of Fame is just mind-boggling, and hopefully this situation gets rectified.
Let's hope so. I mean, that's the whole point. We do stories to shed light on issues, to ask questions, to report, and hopefully that this can bring some sort of resolution to a situation that should have been resolved years ago.
Okay, let's bring it back to the current day now. A good ranking. Everybody loves a good ranking. And let's talk about some quarterbacks. You are in the middle of putting together your quarterback rankings, primary installment for the 2017 campaign, ranking the starters, or I guess potential starters, for all 14 teams in the league. This was actually my responsibility a year ago. I did a quarterback rankings in the league at the end of spring ball, where everything was sort of reset going into the summer. But I want to compare and contrast your list versus mine. I'll go ahead and give you mine 1 through 14. You can give me yours, and we'll try to find somebody a little too high, somebody a little too low, and fight it out like chaps do. So, number one, you got to go with Jalen Hurts, the reigning offensive player in the year in the conference. Number two, I have Austin Allen. Number three, Shea Patterson, probably higher than most. Number four, Jarrett Stidham. Yes, I'm buying some more Auburn stock here. Number 5, Jake Bentley, big fan. Number 6, Nick Fitzgerald. We talked about him a lot earlier. Number 7, Jacob Eason, him as well. Number 8, Drew Locke, big numbers, not a lot of substance. Number 9, Danny Etling. Number 10, Steven Johnson at Kentucky. Number 11, Kyle Shermer. And then I have the 3 open jobs at 12, 13, and 14. With Tennessee, we have Quentin Dormady and Jared Garantano. At Florida, who knows? I hear Malik Zaire one day, Felipe Franks the next, and believe it or not, even Luke Del Rio the next day. And bringing up the rear for me is Texas A&M. Very bad news if you're Kevin Sumlin on that scorching hot seat. Is it Jake Hubenak? Is it Nick Starkel? Is it Kellen Mond? That's 1 through 14 as I see it.
Let's rewind, because I just want to focus on the top 7 here. And a little shameless plug, by the way, that my quarterback story actually came out Wednesday night on Saturday Down South. Go check that out. Little shameless plug.
Plug away.
Yeah. So we have differences in our top 7, and I think that there are 2 major differences. We actually only have 1 different person in our top 7, 1 different quarterback, but it's at the same exact number 3 spot. In your number 3 spot, you got Shea Patterson there. I don't have Shea Patterson in my top 7, and I know that I am getting, or I don't have him in my top 6. I take that back. I know that I'm going to get a lot of crap for that, and I understand. I hear Ole Miss fans loud and clear. But I come back to the same thing that we talked about with Jarrett Stidham. You know, it's 3 career starts, and I understand being a blue-chip recruit, and I understand that, you know, he flashes this ability to make big-time throws. You know, the Texas A&M win was all well and good, but I question the body of work, and it's tough to put a guy in a top 3 spot when it's just not there yet. So tell me why I should be in love with Shea Patterson already.
I'm definitely doing some projecting here. I think something it has to be said for the time that you and I spent down at IMG Academy doing all the big stuff we did, audio, video, and writing, of course, for that story. And I spent a lot of time with Coach Wright, as you did. I asked him several Shea Patterson-related questions, and the more he talked, the more I liked what I heard. This seems like a young man with the right background, with the right attitude, with the right skill set, and I think he has a chance to truly explode in this conference. I think his upside is offensive player of the year. That may not happen in 2017, but 2018, look out. But I watched him play, granted 3 games. He went 1-2 as a starter. It's hard to deny that, but this was at the end of a season where pretty much his entire defense had just given up and decided they weren't going to play anymore. He was a one-man team, but the skills are there, and they are sexy. They are fun to watch. He looks like Johnny Manziel with his head screwed on straight. He doesn't scramble to try to make yards and get himself blasted like Manziel would do. He scrambles to buy time and wait for that big receiving core to break open so he can throw the ball up there and they can win those 50-50 battles. He's in the right offense. And you know what? I think he's in the right situation. If he was a little bit weaker mentally, if he was a little more selfish as a young man, he would have bolted the second that Hugh Freeze turned in his walking papers. But he didn't. He's sticking it out, even though Freeze is his guy. He hasn't transferred. None of his receivers have transferred. None of his offensive linemen have transferred. Not even any of his defensive mates have transferred either. So I think this entire season is a chip on the shoulder, nothing to play for, no bowl game. Let's go out there 12 Saturdays and see what we can do. I think statistically he's going to be sensational. And just from an attitude perspective, he seems to really have it put together for me.
I'm going to make a little comparison here, and this is not an exact comparison, so before Ole Miss fans get up in arms about this, but what you just said right there about sticking it out at a program, you know, a guy that's got a good head on his shoulders, highly touted recruit coming in, there's a little Christian Hackenberg there, kind of similar to the situation that he went through with Bill O'Brien, stuck it out under James Franklin. Obviously the results were not great, but this is a guy that could have went to any other program in the country when things got rough, decided he didn't want to do it, stuck it out. We don't know how that ultimately is going to affect Christian Hackenberg at the NFL level. That book has not been written just quite yet, contrary to what some think. But there are some comparisons there, I don't think I've heard that before. You're right. I mean, the upside is there, and I want to see it, though, and I want to see it on a consistent basis before I say this guy is a top 3 quarterback in the league. And I want to see the weapons around him develop. I want to see how motivated that team is to play without a bowl game this year. I mean, that's such a tough thing to do when you just can't play in the postseason. Like, certain teams can thrive under those circumstances, much like Ohio State did in the first year of Urban Meyer, but not every college kid is motivated to play when there is not an end-of-season goal to attain. So you talked about the defense checking out last year. I'm not saying his offensive teammates are going to check out, but how motivated is this team going to be under a new, you know, a new regime here, so to speak? I don't know. I'm holding off a little bit on Shea Patterson, but we can move on from that because so the guy that I actually had in that number three spot where you had Shea Patterson, I had Nick Fitzgerald in there, and we talked a lot about Fitzgerald, about the dual threat ability, how great he was for this offense. You only have Fitzgerald at number six. The second in the SEC in rushing last year, the talk about Dak, we just talked about how great he was. Why do you only have Nick Fitzgerald at number six?
I think Fitzgerald, for me, again, I sort of alluded to it earlier that, sure, you can throw for 417 yards against UMass. Go for it, young man. And you can run for 258 against an Ole Miss team that had completely quit at that point last week of the regular season in the Egg Bowl. That's fantastic. But he only played three ranked teams a year ago. He only played three defenses of consequence. It was LSU, it was Auburn, and it was Alabama. And I did the numerical breakdown. He averaged about 140 yards passing. Wait a second, he's also a great rusher. Well, he wasn't effective on the ground against any of those teams as well. He threw a grand total of two touchdown passes. He was intercepted twice, so the ratio isn't any good. He lost all three games. He got benched in the LSU game, as a matter of fact. So he can't just keep lighting up these poor defenses. Sure, he looks sensational against Arkansas and some of these other weak teams in the SEC, but he's in the West. He's in the toughest division in college football, and if he's going to make Starkville consequential again, which truly was the magic trick for Prescott, he's got to beat somebody that matters. He has to have a big game that matters. I don't think he delivered an upset last season. Yes, Mississippi State beat Texas A&M, but at that point of the season, the Aggies were in the middle of their typical November swoon. I don't think that Trevor Knight played that game with a shoulder injury, so that's my hesitation on Fitzgerald. I'm a big believer in the upside. He could be two or three by the time the year's over, but I just got to see it against somebody who can actually play defense.
That's fair. I mean, I look at the fact that he had 16 rushing touchdowns in his final eight games of the season, which, you know, that stretch included Alabama and Arkansas and Texas A&M and BYU and, you know, some teams that actually, you know what they're doing. You're right, though. He doesn't have that big signature win yet. You could point to the fact that he's got 54% completion percentage, 6.7 yards per attempt, and a lot of people are going to knock him for that. But I don't know. The more and more I see and hear about this guy, I just think that the sky is the limit for him. And, you know, the Dak comparison that we talked about before is not that crazy. And, you know, whether or not that should be the bar for him, you know, as we talked about, that's, you know, a tough subject. But, you know, I think he can take this offense to new heights. I think he's going to be a guy that's in the top five of my ranking the entire season. I'd be surprised to see him have – I know he's a junior now, but I guess it would be more like a sophomore slump this year. Guy avoided mistakes, was only sacked 14 times last year, 10 interceptions for a guy that had the ball in his hands as much as he did. That's impressive in itself. I just think that this is a guy that did a lot of things that very few across all of college football could do last year.
This wasn't intended to be a battle over the Magnolia State, but clearly it's turning into that. And I want to bring it back to Patterson here, because it sounds like our argument is Patterson versus Fitzgerald. And maybe a reason why I have Patterson as high as I do at number three is that it's hard to make an argument for anybody behind him. Is three probably artificially high? Sure. But who's going to be higher than him in my eyes? You have Jarrett Stidham at Auburn. Yes, I love what I see on tape, but it's really easy to tear it down that it's Baylor, it's the Big 12, it's the air raid. Let's see him play a real defense. Plus, he hasn't been on the field in close to 2 years. Jake Bentley, I had him at five. I really like him. He's got the kind of moxie you love at that position, but it's South Carolina. It's Will Muschamp. Is Will Muschamp really going to unleash the hounds offensively? Does he have enough help? Yes, I love Deebo Samuel and I love Hayden Hurst, but is he going to run the ball well enough? Is he going to be protected enough? And then we have Fitzgerald, but beyond him, Jacob Eason, there were more valleys for him than peaks a year ago. Yes, the incredible game-winning throw against Missouri and the near game-winning throw against Georgia, but you can pull out that Vanderbilt game and the Nicholls State game and the South Carolina game, even in a win there, he was positively atrocious. Again, more valleys than peaks. Are you going to try to sell me Drew Locke? Are you going to try to go with Danny Etling? I mean, the list gets pretty thin awfully quick. So I think almost by default, I can further justify Patterson at 3.
By default? This is supposed to be an improved year of SEC quarterbacks, and you're saying number 3 in your rankings got there by default and not based on merit?
Well, better than last year doesn't necessarily make it good, because it was pretty bad last year overall.
That's fair. For all the reasons that were, you know, that you're hesitant on young quarterbacks anointing them, that's why I'm hesitant on Patterson. And I just think that Fitzgerald is a guy that has proven himself. I mean, if Patterson was, you know, second in the SEC in rushing this year, would we be saying the same things about him that we're saying about Fitzgerald? I mean, I don't know. When you attach the 5-star to it, it all of a sudden just kind of takes on a new life of its own. So, hey, when Shea Patterson goes off this year and he's the talk of the town, and you know he is the rising star of the SEC, I'll be more than willing to give him the credit that he deserves. But it's August, and I'm holding off on that.
The last guy I want to talk about on this list, I think you have him at 7. I have him at 8. So middle of the road for both of us. It's Drew Locke at Missouri, and it sort of has a similar story to Fitzgerald. Granted, he's not a dual threat guy, but he's infamous for throwing for 400 yards and 5 touchdowns against the Western Michigans of the world and the Delaware States of the world. But when he faces a legit SEC defense, he doesn't move the ball. I mean, if you turn on the tape, back-to-back, he played LSU and Florida a year ago, just positively atrocious. I mean, completing a forward pass was a genuine challenge at time. And this is a guy in a Josh Heupel offense going 100 miles an hour, designed to be as quarterback friendly as possible. I like the player. I think the upside is there, but I wonder how good can he be? Has he already sort of reached his ceiling? Are we going to see more from Drew Locke in 2017?
Yeah, I did a number crunch on, because for the exact reasons you just mentioned, non-conference play compared to conference play. And the only real non-conference foe that they faced last year was West Virginia. And in non-conference play, 13 touchdown passes, no interceptions, averaged 353 passing yards a game. In SEC play, 10 touchdown passes, 10 interceptions, 53% passing, 248 passing yards per game. He only had 3 games with multiple touchdown passes. So for those, because there are a lot of Mizzou fans that are saying, you know, he's the best quarterback in the SEC, should at least be in the top 2, whatever, prove it against SEC competition, and then you'll earn a higher ranking in this. That's what I would say to that.
This is one thing that I sort of noticed with my elementary eyes watching Mizzou football a year ago. There was a lot about Josh Heupel coming in as the offensive coordinator. Of course, he wants to go hurry up and spread and wide open and trying to snap the ball 95 plays per game. But what I saw watching some of these games was an offense that was literally going too fast. I can't tell you how many times I saw a series where it almost seemed like the lineman didn't quite know the play call, the receivers were running screwy routes, and the Locke is throwing the ball, expecting the guy to run a hitch when he runs a curl. Just, they were going so fast, so quick, snap to snap. I mean, 25 seconds, still on the play clock, and the ball is going back to number 3. I think there is a such thing as going too fast for your own good. I wonder if taking the foot off the accelerator just a little bit might help this offense. It doesn't mean you have to slow it down and run 60 plays a game, but when you're trying to get into triple digits every single time, there's going to be a lot of misfires there and balked plays that get you nowhere.
Yeah, and I think they were last, if I'm not mistaken, they were last in FBS in time of possession.
Never held on to the ball for a significant period of time, correct.
Yeah, and that hurts the defense too. So, I mean, people say, you know, this offense, you know, it shouldn't have to score 50 points a game to win. Well, I mean, it kind of comes back to the offense too. It's a similar problem that I saw in Indiana a few years ago. It's like, well, yeah, they can score 40 points in a given game, but you know, it's big plays or it's three and outs, and you know, there's not a lot of sustained drive,
and it just murders your defense. It destroys your defense.
Yeah, and we saw that last year with Mizzou. And you know, are they going to be able to slow things down a little bit and kind of sustain drives? To kind of get back to the level they want to be at. I think that's an absolute key.
Connor, good show. We'll do it again next week.
As always, my friend.
All right, that's Connor O'Gara. Remember to follow him on Twitter at CJ O'Gara. You can also follow me at SaturdayJC. And thank you for listening to the Saturday Down South podcast. Special thanks to our friends at WDAE in Tampa, as well as our sponsor, TicketCity.com. If you like what you heard, please go to iTunes and subscribe. There's other ways to do it as well. And be sure to give the show a rating as well. My name is John Crist, and for all SEC all the time, visit SaturdayDownSouth.com.